I'd like to speak this evening on the subject, the personal God. That's what I want to speak about, the personal God. And I've just got two readings, very brief ones. The first one in Exodus chapter 3, verses 13 and 14. Then Moses said to God, "If I come to the people of Israel and say to them, 'The God of your fathers has sent me to you,' and they ask me, 'What is his name?' what shall I say to them?" And God said to Moses, "I am who I am." He said, "Say this to the people of Israel, 'I am has sent me to you.'" One from the Old Testament and now one from the New Testament, Galatians chapter 4. In one way you might say that this talk is not going to be a practical talk, that is in the sense that we're not going to have any great challenge to go out into the regions beyond and great challenges to witness more fervently and to give more money to the Lord and to be more devoted and that type of thing. It's not practical in that sense, but I hope it is practical in the sense that we see that our understanding of God really affects the way we live. I believe that too often people have treated theology, that is our understanding of God and the truths concerning God, they've treated these things rather too lightly at times. And if our understanding of God is wrong, everything else is going to be wrong. And certainly our lives and our service for God are not going to be what they ought to be. So I hope that through it all, as we look at this subject of God, it will indeed be of practical use to us in helping us to be the followers of God that we ought to be. Now in Galatians 4, we have again two verses I want to read, verses 6 and 7. "Because you are sons, God has sent the Spirit of his Son into our hearts, crying, 'Abba, Father.' So through God you are no longer a slave, but a son. And if a son, then an heir." We look at the physical world round about us, and from our observation of the physical world, we conclude that there is a creator, that he is intelligent, and that he is powerful. And that, of course, is what we read in Romans chapter 1. From our observation of the physical world, we conclude that there is an all-powerful and intelligent being. And then from our own understanding of right and wrong, our own conscience, we understand that there is also a moral being, a moral God, to whom we are answerable. And that, of course, is developed in Romans chapter 2. That the very nature of man, his consciousness of right and wrong, is an indication that there is a moral ruler of the universe to whom we are answerable. But God was not content simply to leave us with this vague understanding of the all-powerful creator or the all-intelligent moral ruler of the universe. God has given us a much clearer revelation of himself through history, and he's recorded that for us in the Bible, so that as we read the Bible, we have a much clearer understanding of God. Now, Romans chapter 1 and Romans chapter 2 tells us that nobody can excuse himself by saying he doesn't know, because there's sufficient evidence just in the world and in the nature of man to indicate that there must be a supreme being. But God has gone further than that, and he's given us here in this Bible the much clearer revelation of himself, so that we can read that and understand what sort of a God he is. And when we read the Bible, we find that he's more than simply an impersonal force. You know, you meet people sometimes and they say, "Yes, I believe in a supreme force." Well, that's all right, I believe in a supreme force too. But God is more than simply some impersonal force. He's more than some abstract principle of right and wrong. He is a person. And that's the truth that comes through loud and clear in the Bible. He is a person. He has awareness. He has knowledge, he has will, he has intellect, he has power, he has feelings. I was going to say just like we have, but that would be putting it the wrong way around. It's not that God has these things like we have. We have them because God has them. I think that's the better way of putting it. Because man is made in the image of God, and we have this personal awareness and will and feeling and intellect and emotions and all those things. We have these things because God has them. We are people, we are persons, because God is a person. And of course, when we read the Bible, we know that quite often it refers to God by using personal terms. For example, it speaks of the eyes of God or the hand of God and things like that. Well, it's not that we're to imagine God as a big man with a long white beard. It's not that type of thing that we're to think of. These expressions of God are what technically are called anthropomorphisms. That is, it's attributing to God the features that we're familiar with in human beings. But that's because of our limited understanding. We can only understand a person in terms of that type of terminology, and so it speaks of God in those terms, because God is a person. But of course, God is not limited to this few square feet that I'm standing on here. The point is, of course, that God, though he is a person, is far beyond the limits that we're accustomed to. Now let us consider how we are to know this person. Our understanding, as we're all well aware, our understanding of God is limited, because God is infinite, God is eternal, God is great, and it's not possible for us really to understand all there is about God. We have very finite minds, we are very limited in our understanding. God, of course, has no limits whatever. But although we can't understand everything about God, we can understand some things about God, and we can understand sufficient to enjoy a relationship with him. And that's the emphasis the Bible places. The Bible places the emphasis on the relationship which we can enjoy with God. We may not understand everything about him, but at least we can enjoy the relationship with him. And the illustration that I'd like to use to compare this with is the illustration of a child and the child's parents. Now, the child has only a limited understanding of the world of his parents. I can remember when I was a child, I used to hear my parents talking about income tax returns and talking about mortgage and interest rates and things like that. And, oh, it used to really be mind-boggling for me, all these highfalutin things that the adult world used to discuss. It's very difficult for a child to enter into the business world, the social world, the marital relations world, the whole world of adulthood, because the child simply can't comprehend it. But that doesn't stop the child enjoying a relationship with his parents. And so it is with us. We have only a limited understanding of God, but that doesn't stop us enjoying a relationship with him. And on the other hand, it doesn't stop God communicating with us. Just as, going back to my analogy of the parents and the children, the children may not understand everything, but the parents can still talk to the children. They can explain things to the children in simple language, and they can get across to the child the things that the child needs to know. And so the parents adjust their level of revelation, of communication, so that the children can at least understand things. And so it is with God. God is very gracious. He tells us sufficient for us to live by. He doesn't tell us everything. Much has to remain untold. We don't know the answers to all the problems. We don't know the answers to why there is suffering, why things happen to this person but they don't happen to some other person. We have no clear-cut answers to all the anomalies of life. And God has never promised us he's going to give us answers to all our intellectual queries. But he has promised us he will tell us enough to enable us to live in a right relationship with him. Now, it's because of this that the Bible doesn't give us any complete description of God. Doesn't sit down to describe God and all his bits and pieces as if it's an academic pursuit going through describing how a robot works. The Bible doesn't give us a piece-by-piece description of God, and it very strictly forbids anybody trying to construct such a thing. For example, a physical representation of God. The Bible is very strong in forbidding anything that would be some physical representation of God, because there's no way that the infinite God can be reduced to that type of physical representation. But as I said, the Bible tells us enough for us to know that although this God is great, he is a God with whom we can have a relationship. And that was the point that was emphasized here in Exodus chapter 3. You all know from your reading of the book of Genesis that when God revealed himself in different situations, he often summarized the particular facet of his character that was revealed by giving a name. A name of himself that summarized the aspect of his character which that incident demonstrated. Jehovah Jireh, the Lord will provide. God was a great provider, and that name that was given, Jehovah Jireh, summarized the revelation very nicely in two words. The name of God was an expression of the character of God that was revealed in that incident. Now, the people of Israel didn't know a lot about God. Moses was trying to get through to these boneheaded people something of the nature of God, and they were very, very slow to learn. Moses is scratching his head and he's a bit frustrated, and he comes to God and he says, well, look, if I go to these people and I say you're going to lead them out of slavery and you're going to do this, and they say, okay, give us a name of this God so that we'll know what he's like, what will I tell them? Now, when Moses asked for a name, it's the character of God that he's looking for. And when God gives Moses a name, it's the character of God that God expresses in that name. He doesn't give a name simply to satisfy curiosity. Like I might say, what's the name of so-and-so, so that I can look up a phone book or write him a Christmas card. It's not curiosity to know the technical name. The point is, what is the character that this name would convey? And so God gives this mysterious name. I am who I am. It's translated in different ways in different Bibles. If you look at your margin, I think every Bible will have an alternative somewhere, because it is indeed a mysterious name. And it's deliberately mysterious. It's intended to be mysterious, to show that this God is one that cannot be tied down to a simple formula. I am who I am. Or, as it says in the margin here, I am what I am. Or, I will be what I will be. It's very difficult to put the thing into precise words, because this is the eternal, unchangeable, everlasting, ever-present God. And that's the point of the name. That this God is independent. He is who he is. He is eternal. He is unchangeable. He is always active. He is always present. I am who I am. I will be what I will be. I am what I am. Whatever I choose to be, that I will be, says the Lord. They can be confident that this is their God. He is a God who is always there. He doesn't write any open checks for them. But he says, you can trust me. I will always be consistent in my character. I will never fail you. And in all the varied circumstances which you meet, I will always prove myself sufficiently resourceful to meet all your needs. I will be what I will be. I will be what I am. I am what I am. And so he gives them this very intangible name in a way. It's hard to grab hold of, that name. But that's precisely the point. God says, I want you to live by faith. I don't want you to be hooked on some simple formula. I want you to realize that I am the God, the ever-present one, the eternal one, the abiding one, the absolute one. And I will always prove myself to be faithful, dependable, and sufficiently resourceful to meet all your needs. You trust me. I am the God who is eternal and always present. This was abbreviated sometimes by the word I am, just I am by itself. This raises an interesting point that you've probably heard about before, that the Jews, the name Jehovah, the Jews didn't take that name upon their lips. They believed it to be so holy, and they had such a deep respect for God that they did not even take that name upon their lips. One of the difficulties is, of course, we don't know how that name was pronounced originally. You know, in the Hebrew language, originally only the consonants were written, and the vowels were simply assumed. People knew where to put the vowels. They didn't write the vowels when they wrote Hebrew. The Hebrew language has 22 letters in the alphabet, but they're all consonants. Vowels don't count. The same in the Thai alphabet, incidentally. We have 44 letters in the Thai alphabet, but they're all consonants. Vowels don't count. Vowels are simply signs and bits and pieces that attach themselves to consonants. And so the Hebrews wrote just in their consonants. But when they came to this word Jehovah, which consisted of four consonants, Y, H, W, H, rather than pronounce it, they put in the word Adonai, which is another word for God, and didn't have that same feeling of awe about it, because they would not take this holy name upon their lips. Many, many years later, when they came to put the vowels into the Hebrew Bible, they didn't quite know how to put the vowels under this word, because the word had more or less fallen into disuse, and they didn't know how to pronounce it. So they took the consonants, Y, H, W, H, and then they put the vowels of Adonai onto it and came up with the word Yehovah. And so that's how we have our word Jehovah. But they knew, and everybody else knows, that that was not originally the word as it was pronounced. Most likely it was Yahweh or something like that. That seems to be the way it was pronounced. That's more or less by the way. The reason I mention it is this, that that word, Yahweh or Jehovah, the consonants, Y-H-W-H, they are from the same root as the word I am who I am. What I'm getting around to saying is this. When God gave that name to Moses, what he was really doing was giving an explanation to the people of what Yahweh, Jehovah, should really have meant to the people. Now, they had known the name before. You can read back through Genesis and Exodus and you'll find the name is there. But they didn't really know the significance of it. And now this explanation here, I am who I am, is really an explanation of what the name Jehovah should have meant to the people anyway. They should have realized that this God was indeed the High and Holy One, the Absolute One. It's interesting to note that because of this confusion concerning how to translate the name or how to transliterate the name, a lot of Bibles skate right around the problem by simply using the word the Lord and putting it in capital letters. So to summarize that, what sort of God do we have then? Well, the sort of God we have is this personal God who is not simply the great one out there, the one with the unpronounceable name. He is the one who is always ready by his people and will always meet his people's need. He will always be there to prove himself and to do the things he chooses to do. He's not going to write any open checks for them, but he is going to say to them, you can always trust me and I'll always be dependable and I'll never let you down. Now, as you read through the story of the Old Testament, you find that the character of God unfolds more. God certainly doesn't rely simply upon mysterious names to convey something of his character to us, but you find there are many, many clear statements concerning the character of God as you find the story developed in the Old Testament. We find that this one who is the source of all things himself had no source. He needs no one, and yet he supplies everybody else's needs. He is the source of all things, but he himself has no source. He can meet all their needs, yet he himself has no needs. They can all depend on him, but he depends on no one. He is answerable to no one. He is the absolute one. He acts in any particular way because he chooses to. He is sovereign. He does what he wants to do because he chooses to do it, not because anybody requires him to do it. He is God. Yet at the same time, he is not a fickle God. He is always consistent to his own character of truth and righteousness and holiness and justice and love. So although he is not answerable to anybody, and although he acts as he desires to act, he never acts in a way which is fickle. He always acts in a way which is consistent with his own absolute character of righteousness and holiness. But more important, we find that this God is responsive to the needs of man. Because although he is great, this one here that we've seen, I am who I am, the eternal, the absolute, the unchanging one, the ever-existent one, the always active one, although he is great beyond the comprehension of man, great beyond the universe, in spite of all that, he is still involved in man's world. This great God is God of everything, beyond time, beyond anything that we can imagine. Yet he's interested here in what I have in my hand. He's interested in what's in your pocket. He's interested in the things going through your mind. He's interested in somebody else who happens to have a headache. The same God who is so great is yet involved in the nitty-gritty, in the ordinary things of man's world. The remarkable thing is that although he is absolute, utterly powerful, sovereign, he has still given to man the freedom to choose the things that he wants to do in this world. So that man can live his life in the presence of this God, and yet man still has the freedom to act. But he's not acting outside the authority of God. God still maintains his authority. Even though man has freedom, God still maintains his authority, and God still directs the course of events towards the desired goal which God has in mind. Now, the best proof text of that is, of course, the one in Acts chapter 2 concerning our Lord Jesus Christ, where Peter said, "You Jews, by wicked hands, took him and crucified him." Wicked hands. You wicked people, by wicked hands you took him and crucified him, and yet, in the same breath, he says, he was delivered according to the determinate counsel and foreknowledge of God. So even though man has this freedom to live in this world, he thinks he's independent of God, but he's not really. because nothing is outside the control of God. Man might rebel against God, but God has set a limit. Man is not independent of God, even if he thinks he is. Even Satan is not independent of God, and we must realize that. We mustn't think of Satan as if he's a bad God, as if Jehovah's the good God and Satan's the bad God. Satan's not equal to God. He's not the opposite of God. Satan is a created being, like any angelic being. I suppose if you want a counterpart of Satan, you'd think of Michael or someone like that, Michael the archangel, good angels and bad angels. But even Satan is not independent of God. God is sovereign. God is over everything. Man rebels, but over the whole rebellious universe we have our sovereign God. This is well illustrated, of course, in the book of Job, where Satan wants to do certain things, but he cannot act beyond the limit God has set. You know the story of how he wants to do this to Job and do that to Job and then do something else to Job, and God says, but so far and no further. He is not independent of God. God is always in control. This is something which we must always bear in mind, because it is the thing which gives us confidence that the world has not got out of control. Sometimes people think it has. They think the whole place is going to pot, and somehow God is losing the reins and things are getting a bit slippery and God's not quite as much in control as he ought to be. Certainly man is making a mess of things, but he is still not outside the sovereign rule of God. And in spite of all the things that are working, God is directing the whole course of history towards the goal which he himself has in mind. He himself knows the end from the beginning, and ultimately, of course, his will be done. So God is responsive to the changing circumstances of life. I think we've got to remember this. And the reason I pointed this thing out is that we must not think of God as some sort of great big robot in the sky, as if he's like a giant clockwork machine. You wind him up and let him go and everything ticks along according to God's determinate counsel and will. So the whole thing is very mechanical. We find as we read the Bible that God can be moved to compassion. We find that God can be moved to anger. You read in the beginning that God placed man in the world, and we have God's desire for man's blessing. You get on a few chapters and God says, my spirit will not always strive with man. He says, man's rebellious and I'm going to punish him. And so blessing can change to judgment. And then you get other cases where the opposite happens. Judgment can turn to blessing. The Ninevites, Jonah goes and preached to them, and although they were told that they were going to be overthrown within 6 weeks, the people repented, and so God was merciful to them. You see, God is working in his world. He's a personal God. He's not out there somewhere just letting the whole show tick by. God is involved. We may not be able to measure God's involvement in the sense that we can take a picture of something and say there's God's hand doing something, but nothing is happening other than God is involved. God has the whole thing at his fingertips, if I can use that expression. And God is responsive, so he can turn and judge when people are rebellious. He can forgive and bless when people are repentant. He knows the end from the beginning. Nothing takes God by surprise. We're not to get this idea that somehow things were going along and then something got out of kilter and God got a bit of a shock and thought, boy, I'll better pull this thing back into line again and straighten something out because it's running off the rails. Nothing takes God by surprise. God is the eternal one who sees everything as present before him, and he knows what is happening. He doesn't come in with a heavy-handed judgment every time something goes wrong. If God came in with a heavy-handed judgment every time man rebelled or did something evil, well, the whole universe would have disappeared centuries ago. But God is gracious, he's long-suffering, he's forbearing, and he withholds judgment so that men might have the opportunity of seeing their folly and turning from it. So when we speak of God as being unchangeable, we must know what we mean by the expression, God is unchangeable. You know the reference there from Malachi chapter 3, where God says, I am the Lord, I change not. Well, when it says that, it doesn't mean to say that God is like a big machine. We mustn't think of God as if he is somebody who is in bondage to fixed laws, like a big robot or a great big computer or something like that, just being driven along by inflexible laws. When it talks about God being unchangeable, it doesn't mean to say that God is mechanical. What it means is that God is unchangeable in his character. He is unchangeable because he's perfect. He is not fickle, that's what it's saying. In his character, he is unchangeable. His qualities are unchangeable. His standards are unchangeable. His values don't change. He is always perfect love. He's never anything less than perfect love. He is always perfect in justice. He is always perfect in holiness. He's always perfect in power. The reason he is unchangeable is because he has all his qualities in perfection. He cannot increase or decrease in love because he holds love in perfection. He cannot increase or decrease in power because he has power in its perfection. He cannot increase or decrease in wisdom, knowledge, love, justice, and so on, could go on and on. He cannot increase or decrease because he has these things in perfection. And it's in that sense that God is unchangeable. So when we say that God is unchangeable, we must not think that God is not responsive. God is responsive to the needs of man. He said that to the people of Israel, "I will always be there. I am the God who is there. I am who I am. I will be what I will be, and you can trust me. Wherever you are, there I am." He is responsive to man's needs. He is unchangeable in the sense that he is always perfect. Whatever he does is totally consistent with the perfection of his character and the perfection of the qualities and standards and values which he holds. That guarantees the consistency in all of God's dealings. God will do only what is right. That's a great encouragement, because sometimes we look at things and we get a bit befuddled and we think to ourselves, why does that happen? Why does God allow this to happen? That looks anomalous. Surely that shouldn't happen. Here we have the righteous suffering and the wicked getting off scot-free. And all these anomalies, all these things, the suffering in the universe and all the apparent inconsistencies, all the injustice we see on every hand, we want to know why all the time. But I think as we look at the character of God and we come to understand what this character is, we are reminded that God is in control. He is always acting in the perfection of his own character, and there is an underlying consistency in all that he does. Now, when it comes to us, the relationship that he has with us is not simply as the God who is there, but the God who is there with us as our Father. He is the source of all things, we said that at the beginning, and in that sense, you might say, he is the Father of all things. He is the source of all life, so he's the Father of creation. He's the Father of the spirits of all flesh. There is a sense in which God is the Father of all things because he is the source of all things. Nothing exists apart from God. But there's a specific sense in which he is the Father, and that is he's the Father of us who believe. And that's the reference here in Galatians. The Father of his people, those who've repented and turned in through faith, come into a relationship with him. Now, the illustration that's given here is the illustration of adoption, that we might receive the adoption as sons. That's the last part of verse 5. And because we are sons, God has sent his Spirit into our hearts, and so we cry, Abba, Father. I can remember being bothered about this, and I think a lot of people are bothered about it, because I've had the question put to me several times at camps and other places. This idea of adoption bothers people because they thought we were born into God's family, and to be adopted into God's family looks a little bit second rate. It's not quite the same as being born into it. And so there's this confusion in people's minds. Well, really, there's no confusion. What we must realize is that the wonders of salvation are manifold. There are many aspects, many ways of looking at it, and many illustrations are given. And each illustration looks at it from one angle. For example, justification is an illustration drawn from the law courts. Redemption is an illustration drawn from slavery. Adoption is an illustration drawn from the adopting of a son into the family to inherit the father's property. And so one could go on. The new birth, that is an illustration of regeneration. Something which is dead is given life. God gives it life, regenerates it. Now, each of these is a different aspect of salvation. We're not to try to marry them all together and say, how is it that a person can be a slave, finish up in the law court, and at the same time be the son of a person into whose family he was born, but also adopted? If we start trying to link them all together and get into that type of hookup, we're going to get ourselves totally confused. What we do is we say each one illustrates a certain aspect of truth. And the particular truth that's being illustrated is usually one main point. Here, for example, the point that's being illustrated is this. We, who were outside of God, are now brought into God's family. And we have the status in God's family of his sons. It was a well-known first century practice that a person might adopt another person into his family so that that person could carry on the family name, inherit the family property, and have the full status of a son. The emphasis here is on the dignity and the maturity and the adulthood of the sonship. That's the point of it. What Paul is saying is this. We come into God's family not as second-rate people, not as people who just made it by the skin of their teeth or through somebody's benevolence. We come as the fully grown, adult, mature sons of God with the full status of sonship and all that goes with it. And we are heirs of what God promises us. And so we can call God Abba, Father. This great God we've been talking about, we now call him Abba. Now that word Abba, that's a word that no Jew would have used when addressing God. It was a Hebrew word, or an Aramaic word if you like, but no Jew would have used that word in addressing God. We saw earlier that the Jews hesitated even to use that name Yahweh or Jehovah, too holy to pronounce. They certainly would never have used the word Abba. It's very difficult for us in English to think of what is the equivalent of Abba. Certainly, Father is a bit too stilted, and Dad is a bit too familiar. I guess it's not quite possible to get an exact equivalent of what that would have meant to the person there. But it is a term of intimacy. It is a term whereby a son could speak to his father with the understanding of filial relationships, with the freedom, with the openness, and yet at the same time the respect and the love. Now that, says Paul, is the way we address God. He is Abba. He is our Father. And we are his sons in the full, adult, mature sense of that word. Well, now let's compare these two things. Here we have the people of Israel, and they know God as I am who I am, the eternal one, the ever-present one, and yet that holy name of Jehovah they wouldn't take upon their lips. Nevertheless, they knew him as the personal God. When you come to the New Testament, what do you find? You come to the New Testament here, we find another word, a word which the Jews would hesitate to use, Abba. And yet, says Paul, that is the word that we can use. That is the word we do use. He says we talk to God as our Father. The one that the Hebrews knew, but yet hesitated to come too close to. He says that same one we draw near to, and we address him with the confidence and yet the respect of a son addressing his father. Not only do we address him as such, he says, but we receive his inheritance. All that he has for us is ours. Because it's his, he says it's yours. The personal God has come to us. The great God of the universe is as close to us as the nearest living relative that we can think of. Now, what's this mean to us? What's the practical implication of this? I believe it is this, that as we go forth to speak with people and present this God to them, how do we present him? As the big, powerful, impersonal force of the universe? Or as the abstract principle of moral justice that governs the universe? Is it just a sort of philosophical thing? Or is it something that is my Lord and my God, my Father? Now that's the difference. There are a lot of people around the world that believe in a force, that believe in a principle of right and wrong. They believe in something out there. But the thing is, do they really believe in God in this personal way? Now, how are they going to know this God in the personal way? Well, I believe they're only going to know him as we take him to them. We can convey to them through our speech and through our teaching or whatever we're saying to these people that this God that we're talking about is not someone remote, but he's someone who is as real to me as the person that shares my own house with me. And so I can convey to them that this God we're talking about is not simply a theory, not simply a principle, not simply an abstract concept or a notion, but he's my Lord and my God. He's the same God that the Israelites worshipped, the same God that Paul talks about, and he's the same God that we follow. He's a personal God.